The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 323, Some Versions of EPIC, LDS Perspectives and Practice, by Michael Collins.
And since we only have 100 to begin with, that suggests that I'm rather retiring. And so it is both an honor and rather frightening to be in the center of things here in Salt Lake, after spending most of my life on the fringe of many things. And to compound the problem, I'm talking about poetry, which is not a popular subject. Putting it in a nutshell, most of the poets of the 20th century seem to have devoted most of their energy at antagonizing their readership. And so we're in a society now that looks upon poetry somewhat askance. And we assume it will be something we can understand. And either we feel stupid because we don't understand it, or we don't want to waste our time with something we don't understand. And about 15 years ago, I was doing some research on Orson Scott Card, who was a fine novelist and a fine storyteller. And I read an article of his called Fantasy and the Believing Reader that talks about fantasy in terms of inviting people in and allowing the story to change the person. And he noted, I think quite correctly, that most modern scholars don't want to be changed. And modern poetry is ideal for that, because you can examine it, take it apart, put it back together, and never actually get into it enough that it changes who and what you are. It's safe poetry. It's intellectualized poetry. Before I went on my mission, I got my bachelor's degree in English, and figured if I ever wrote anything, it would be scholarship, because I had shown up to that point absolutely no creativity. I wrote one sonnet that I had to write. I wish I'd kept it because it was so terrible. And it was footnoted. I knew I was going to be an English major. Just in case the teacher was too stupid to catch on, I footnoted everything in it and then threw it away, and I wish I'd kept it. But while I was on my mission, I had a number of experiences that kind of forced me into myself and made me probably more alone than most missionaries would be in terms of the kinds of companions I had and in terms of some problems that I was having. And I woke up one night with a rhythm pounding in the back of my mind, and I didn't recognize it at the time. I just grabbed my missionary journal. It was about 11 o'clock, and my companion was still up writing to his girlfriend an hour and a half after deadline. So I grabbed my journal and just started writing in it. And I wrote 200 lines that night. And the next day when I looked at it, I realized that it was kind of version of what Beowulf sounded like. And I began exploring the whole idea of extended poetry, because it isn't common and it isn't popular and it is difficult. When I returned from my mission, I was fortunate enough to do graduate work at the University of California, Riverside, under Professor John M. Stedman, who was one of the world's leading Milton scholars. I fell in love with Milton years before. I had worked at a summer camp after I graduated from high school and decided that I was going to prepare to be an English major in college, and brought the Norton Anthology and planned on reading the whole thing, both volumes, in my spare time. Well, I must admit I didn't get through the whole thing. In fact, I still haven't gotten through the second volume. I found Milton instead, and I found myself sitting out in the morning in the sun by the nature hut while all of the camp was down at the lakefront swimming. And I was sitting there in the warm breeze all by myself reading Paradise Lost out loud and just feeling the sounds of the words as they came across my tongue, and falling in love with Milton. And gradually discovering that Milton is quite right in a number of ways. He's a fascinating writer for an LDS reader, an LDS poet, because he comes so close so frequently. As part of my classwork, I took a course called Milton from John Stedman. It's the reason I went there, is to take that class. And he began actually by having us take a full year pre-seminar on the epic, and we spent that year studying how epics are put together, what they're composed of, beginning with Gilgamesh in some 3000 BC and moving all the way through to 1957 with Nikos Kazantzakis' continuation of the Odyssey, which is Ben Homer's original version. And along the way, we read almost all of the major epics in the language. And Stedman is very much into structure. He was telling us how epics are put together and what they have to have. Gave us a list of conventions. And I sat down to memorize it one day in preparation for the exam that I knew was coming and thought, you know, the best way to learn these conventions is not to memorize them, but to do them. And to see what it would feel like to commit yourself to a poem that you feel in some way defines the society to which you belong, the world in which you find yourself. I probably could have only done that when I was in my 20s. There's a certain arrogance that goes with the 20s that made it possible. I realize now that I was kind of like Tasso, whose father was an epic poet, and who had written his epic by the time he was 19, and then realized he wasn't anywhere near prepared for it, and went back and did the prerequisite pastorals and Georgic kinds of poetry before he finally did his true epic in the later years of his life, Jerusalem Delivered, three versions of it. But being young and arrogant and full of energy, I decided to write an epic in my spare time. So the first question is, what do I write about? Well, it has to be LDS. That's why I would want to write one. It has to be Book of Mormon. After all, Milton took the best story, the most important story for all of humanity, so I couldn't redo his. But what single story could I tell that would allow me to write a 12-book Renaissance epic and at the same time give it enough narrative structure to keep it from being just philosophical meanderings? And the obvious answer for me at the time was Nephi and the Sword of Laban. One of the times in the Book of Mormon where to do that which is always considered false is the right thing. And to do that which we would consider right is the wrong thing. And without that single episode, the rest of the Book of Mormon would not have happened. I'm very pleased that I chose it now, because some 15 years later, I met Orson Scott Card, and we've been friends since, and I can honestly say his Homecoming series had absolutely nothing to do with my Nephi ad, because mine was finished about 15 years before he started his. But it's the same story, that same moment, when the whole moral, ethical, social, political, etc. weight of the episode provides a fulcrum. And what seems simple and clear to us must have been extremely difficult and very unclear. So choosing that story, I then began my Nephiad. It begins, I'm not going to read the whole thing, it's only 6,500 lines. It begins, as any good epic should, by talking about the nature of epic. And after several pages of introduction talking about Milton and talking about the whole idea of the poet as prophet, the poet as revelator, the poet, in this case me, the poet begins to speak about being a poet and what it requires and the story that this poem is going to tell. Of heroes hidden long in earth's gray dust, of nations long to men unknown, I sing. Of nations led by Israel's God into a western paradise, scant years before the tyranny of Babylon destroyed God's temple city fair. Of brothers' ire against a righteous youth, poisoning with hatred's venomous edge generations of their progeny. Of men both fair and dark. Of the Spirit's awesome power manifest through Nephi's courage, to write of these I set my humble pen. By the way, that's a convention. The poet must always proclaim his humility, even though the act of writing an epic poem is an act of arrogance and pride. So you'll have to forgive the pose that I was forced to take. To write of these I set my humble pen, but not of all. For prophets long ago have written full accounts upon bright metal plates by Joseph's diligence brought forth, by Nephi's faith attained for Lehi's seed, Nay, I intend to tell but partial tale, an episode, important in itself and in its implications for my day. For in this single act is all contained that Mormon's golden-throated words relate, the means by which a chosen race of God preserved was from ignorance and death through actions more than martial by a youth performed, a youth in years, though not in form, who fortitude of soul exhibited, great strength in serving high divine desires, great wisdom in discerning heaven's desires. Book two deals with Laman and Lemuel arguing against their father Lehi and his dream. It introduces Sam and Nephi. Book three begins at dawn, and in every epic you must begin at dawn so that morning's ruddy fingers can call upon the sky, etc. So I did. And Lehi meets with his sons to bid them farewell as they leave for Jerusalem. At one point in Book 5, the sons are outside the city gates, and Laman begins his visit into the city to retrieve the brass plates. Thus Laman, with deep pride, inborn of years of wealth and elder sway, or Lemuel, Sam, and last-born Nephi, and fair siblings of the maternal sex, his way into the city of dead kings with forceful stride betook, as one who heedless flaunts divine decree and acts in ignorance of high commands, devised as heaven's God and earth's great Lord, in council joined with first created souls to set wide worlds in axis spinning tracks across the universe, to spread from Kolob to the farthest ends of time, and create dwellings for eternal, infinite intelligences from before the worlds and gods began. Yea, heaven's highest God, by his own first begotten spirit son, the only son begotten in the flesh by Elohim's descendant love upon a gentle waiting maid, his righteous love, not rapine rude by Zeus within those forms of swan and bull and golden shower to hide his pretext from his victims and his justly angered vengeful wife. Thus he, Laman, strode full unconcerned by words and counsel messages countenanced by gods, as in the pure imperium where they dwell, high-throned above the turquoise globe of earth, within the glassy globe of Kolob's sphere, Urim and Thummim for a universe, itself a source of revelation's fire, great Elohim, encircled by sweet praise of countless concourses of daughters, sons in spirit fine conceived and given life, communed with his anointed ready heir. That's one sentence, by the way. That's another thing epic poets had to do. Elevate the language. You're talking about the story that is at the core of who and what you are, and therefore it must sound different than the way you speak each day. The words, the language, the structures. And the fascinating thing about the Miltonic verse is that when you get into it, you begin to think that way. And you sit down and you write passages of 200 lines that make some sort of sense. I would defy any English teacher to diagram it as a sentence, but it makes the kind of sense that you need to make. Book 5. It is evening now. None stirs but I. Alone within the silent fastness of my room, surrounded by soft soundlessness of sleep, I invoke again the unfettered muse. Not Calliope, the epic muse, but sweet Urania, celestial patroness, whispering, sustaining truths to waiting ears of those for whom she bore pure spirit flesh, enclosing immortalities in preparation for estates to come, divine precursor of poetic flights that bear the earth-tide poet's searching mind to crystal worlds above more common molds. In Book 5, Laman returns to his brothers empty-handed and urges them to return to Lehi. Nephi counters with his suggestion that they should instead do as they have been told to do. And at this point, I took some of the poetic license that I would take in the poem to talk about what Nephi might have done had he known what was coming. This is one of the other prerogatives of an epic poet. You get to use the future, or the past is the future. And I'd like to read a fairly extended passage that has to do with one of the immediate repercussions of Nephi's decision, and that is the foundation of the church, building the temple in Kirtland, being forced from Kirtland, forced by ignorance and fear. They fled, wandered through green, fertile plains until prophetic wisdom forged from misty swamps the city beautiful, snow-white Nauvoo with her crystal diadem and light, the temple. Pure against the wintry sky, white star stones, moonstones, sun stones, garlanding in a smooth-worked brow, mute tributes to high ranks of governors controlling movements through vast cosmic time and space in answer to the informed desires of heaven's God. Yea, thus bedecked with stones, the temple stood, serene, an island of ultramundane calm amid smoke and flames demonic, terrors of Morion flames as lawlessness rebelled against true order and degree. Foul hate overwhelming mobs as beautiful Nauvoo pale victim fell to ravaging and rape, to untimely horrifying death of God's anointed spokesman, priest, and seer. Just as proud Jerusalem would fall in Lehi's time to Babylon's dire power, her massy walls of stone o'erthrown and razed, her populace in rags and bondage led into the furthest reaches northward set, there to serve in pale servitude, until Jehovah once again should cause return to ruins which once knew David's crown. The city of Nauvoo is destroyed, and then, yet once again, a third time, seek pure hearts persuaded by the truth of Joseph's life to rear an edifice to God. In wastes and salty desert barrenness, they build foundations deep of granite carved by hand, and slowly o'er the span of 40 years, see pinnacles arise to form arched skies, pinnacles of stone that rise to sweep with matchless majesty the clouds themselves. Three Aaronic, three Melchizedek, with one great golden trumpeter atop the highest point, though placed there not as Christ, by Satan's sinuous wiles to tempt with sin the Son of God to worship darkness' blight, foiled when Christ God did not fall, but stood, pronouncing thus, also it is written, tempt not the Lord thy God. But rather, as a symbol of the light, to eastward dawning as he standing waits, Moroni messenger in gold enrobed, prepared to trumpet forth the coming God to wake the waiting world with his call. Their temple is complete, the third one, though not the one in which all heavenly glories reflect, in which telestial, terrestrial, and high celestial worlds reflect their perfect states and give to erring hearts a pattern sure, a pattern visible that leads to God. In book 6, the brothers negotiate what to do next. In book 7, Lehi enters. In book 8, he sees a figure. Notice how rapidly these books go by. They're actually about 30 pages each, so I talk a great deal in them. And Lehi finds someone's lying on the ground. As Nephi bent low over Laban's breast, not touching quite the prostrate mountainous form, a subtle glint of gold tore at his eye. His hand thrust forward, grasped the golden hilt, withdrew it from its carved protective sheath, until the blade, as beauteous as those so detailed lovingly in pagan myth, blessed with names and genealogies them ascribed by masters of crude lore, blades cognominal, as famous as the illustrious arms that brandished them aloft. Frontum, hero-born, battle-lightning wielded against Grendel's dam beneath a mighty black tarn, though irresolute and blunted by her scaly flesh, a worthy blade for Beowulf, dark-doomed Geat priest. Seeing all of the... I then proceed with this. Sorry about this. It's been a long day already. A catalog of great swords, and relate the tradition of swordplay back to Laban, back to Nephi, and then comes the moment of debate. And here is the one point at which the poem diverges from Book of Mormon sources. I wanted Nephi to argue both sides of a complete discourse. And so an angel arrives, dressed as an angel, or being dressed as an angel of light, and tells him to kill Laban. And just as the angel states that, a second angel appears. That's my addition. This is a poem. This is not scripture. A second angel appears, a mighty king, and argues from the laws of Moses and from all of the laws that God has ever given, thou shalt not kill. And the two angels debate whether to kill or not to kill, and Nephi stands between them and listens. I had to make it external. I tried not to, but I had to make it external. And finally, Nephi makes his decision and forces the angel, the king, the dark king, to leave, listens to the final words of the bright angel. The angel's word released a memory. Recalled those promises first made the youth beside his altar near the Red Sea's flow. Jehovah's promises that Nephi's seed should flourish in far lands and to them given, dependent on obedience and faith. This Nephi's mind recalled. Yet when he thought to speak once more and to the messenger, the light was gone, and he alone stood over Laban's drunken corpulence with sword unsheathed, naked in the night. Commanded by the Spirit of the Lord, Nephi raised the sword, a moment paused, then struck with severing might his kinsman's neck, and closely wrapped in Laban's wine-stained cloak with sheathed blade about his waist begirt, Nephi disappeared into thick night. And it was rather startling for me to discover that the purpose of the poem, the reason I told the poem, the story that the poem was going to tell, was affected in a single line. And the rest of it is leading up to it, and the remaining four books, the ramifications of it. I'm not going to read any more from the Nephiad, in part because it was difficult to choose what to read in the first place. It's like having 6,500 children and choosing which ones to bring forth in company. But this gives you an idea of the kind of poem it is. It is self-consciously an old poem. It's a 17th century Renaissance encyclopedic epic that brings to bear everything I know about everything I know. The first draft was finished while I was in graduate school. Fortunately, I probably would never have gone any further with it. Three people read it, which is two more than I expected. My wife, I knew, would read it because she's a wonderful and caring person. Two other people actually read the poem. One hated it, and it happens to be someone whose opinion I admired greatly. He was at the time on faculty at BYU. I still admire him greatly. I think he was mistaken in his judgment. His primary comment was, "Why did you waste your time? The story has already been told clearly, directly, coherently. We don't need another version of the story." And because I was busy with other things, minor details like raising a family and getting a job and things of that sort, I set it aside. Also because I couldn't bear the thought of typing the thing over and it was too expensive to Xerox it. And then my university gave me a computer. They should never have done that. They should have known better. And over the course of 4 or 5 years, I transferred all of my poetry, about 1,500 poems, from manuscript to disk, except the Nephiad. It was too long. I just didn't want to deal with it. And then they gave me a new computer, a better one, a faster one. And I decided I would at least type it in because I wanted to have a copy. I wanted to have more than just that one. I typed the first page and realized I'd made three changes already. Threw my hands in the air in despair and said, why not? I'll revise as I go. And I actually added about 1,000 lines to it for this final version. It was published 2 years ago. I have a good friend who is a small press in Southern California. She does nothing but poetry books. Each of her books are handmade, except for putting the print on the page. We construct the books, and she very graciously worked with me, and out of it came a printed, published copy of the Nephiad, and now about 12 people have read it. which is 10 more than I ever expected. But I realized, being at some level a pragmatist, that I really can't expect people to buy a 6,500-line poem written in a language that really passed out of use 300 years ago. Written from an academic point of view, but I don't think in academic terms. That is, it embodies everything I have learned about epic in the preceding 30 years. My additions to the original version reflect readings in epic theory, readings in Renaissance theory. It reflects readings in LDS history. It reflects a fascination with some of the cosmic utterances of Parley P. Pratt and Johnny Widsoe and others. It's a demanding poem. But I felt that I still wanted to write an epic. And so I said, all right, Milton did a long one. He did Paradise Lost. And then when he was finished, and he wasn't dead, he did another one. He did a short one, Paradise Regained. And in it, he broke many of the rules. At the time, I'd been playing around with sonnets. I had become kind of obsessed with sonnets. And was struggling to figure out how you write a sonnet that doesn't sound like a sonnet. One that is but isn't. And I began breaking the rules, changing it from meter to syllable count, from strict rhyme scheme to half rhyme to analytic rhyme to all sorts of strange and peculiar rhyming devices that I've worked with over the years. And did about 50 of those until I felt comfortable with the form. The 50 have been published as a book called Rememory. And that kind of closed out that sequence of my writing life. And I started writing poems about Joseph Smith, and I realized, here is my epic hero. Of course, he has to be. Who else? But what can I say? What story can I tell? Especially in sonnet form. Because I wanted this one to be accessible, little bits and pieces that weld together to create the story, rather than the Nephiad, which is the entire story, and you've got to read all 6,000 lines to get it. And then I was invited to be the scholar guest of honor at a conference, the Mythopoeic Society, a group of people who are fascinated by C.S. Lewis. And I had been asked to read a paper on Orson Scott Card as a Mythopoeic poet and as an epic poet. And by the time I left that conference, I had my subject in mind. Joseph Smith is our King Arthur. What more logical than Arthurian poems? The speaker of the poem is Taliesin. Taliesin is Arthur's poet. He is with Arthur from the beginning. The first poem, Taliesin, Dedication, is a poem to Orson Scott Card in the persona of Brother Prayer, in which I say, you have told your stories. This was shortly after the Seventh Son series began. You have told your stories about your Joseph Smith. I'm going to tell a different story about a different Joseph Smith. The fourth poem. Taliesin recounts the wound to Arthur's leg. It might have been an arm, a shoulder blade, a rib, the 13th, hearkening to its mate, a hip joint, traitor turned to cowled leg, or even an eye, obscured by an unseen mote. It could have been any of these, his body turned against the man soul inhabiting, but it was his leg. Infected badly, microscopic darkness, orbiting blood, destroying it. That's simple. To kill the king before his crown could fit full-forged. But excised, bone cut out with bloody care, removed, the sickness could no longer gorge itself on him and die. Wounded, healed, lamed, he bore its lifetime scars, this Fisher King. Arthur and the head of Bran. Bran was an ancient druidic prophet whose head was buried, and if you dug it up, it told you the truth. In the last hour of his child time, Uther's son braved Tower Hill alone to find out for himself what enduring powers there be. Secluded under trees sacred to gods from time beyond living memory, he exhumed the head of Bran, studied its worm-smooth brow. Wide as imagined seas, the skull stared hollowly. Knowledge eddied through Uther's sun. Bren has no eyes, no ears, no mouth. He cannot speak green truth, listen to revolving prayers rising, see tear sacrifice valiant hearts. He hastened from Tower Hill, eyes aflame, breast aflame, voiceless skull in hand, and Arthur announced God's name. The Grail. Hidden beyond westward mists and sun sleeps, beyond waves of grasses green-brown ripe and hunched flanks of mountains and royal streams deep with life, it sleeps also and dreams and sends its dreams in dreams to Arthur, where he lies wide-eyed on a garret beneath rough hand-hewed singles that weep yet sticking tears and glimmer lightness, dim but still enough to catch his waking dreams and cast them high as mountain pinnacles and reflect them in six-spired elegance and draw from eyes that see beyond rough wooden shingles to the one, tears unspoken for the vessel and blood of Christ, granite encased for Galahad. Arthur and Guinevere. West and south, where fabled silvered metals rested, or were hoped to rest, in rich earth, he journeyed, not just to solve their riddles, but to bring beauty to his granite hearth. Instead of buried silver, raven locks. Instead of dark clasped secrets, hazel eyes. Instead of harsh earth scrabbling, heartfelt looks. Instead of metal hoards, love promised ease. She journeyed north and east with Hans' bride to share the visions of his city soon to bloom. She bore him children, living and dead, transformed coarse tents into mansion home. But when he fell, and we pursued the dream, she stayed behind and would not follow him. Arthur and the Serpents. They gathered in tight knots around three snakes, coiled, sinuous as dragon's breath. Rude men prodded diamond scales with blunt-tipped oak sticks torn from nearby trees, once straight, living, green. The men prodded, stirring dumb serpents to wrath, then poised on the edge of slaughtering them as if awaiting his permissive word. Instead, he held his warriors back, a dam across floods of fear and anger. He warned against thoughtless death. Later, one night awoke to find a serpent warmed beside his cheek. And thus at peace, no fight between them, they shared a bed, he said, and none could know which was lamb and which was lion. Taliesin and Arthur's majesty at the founding of the city. I have witnessed his majesty in lands none living would possess. In wilderness, wastes rejected and reviled, lands he blessed with vast visions and mild words of command. I have witnessed his majesty in swamps, pestilent, malarial, where each breath bred fever chills, delirium, and death. His touch evaporated deadly damps. I have witnessed his majesty in tents, mildew-mottled, torn, ravaged by winds and rains, encampments baser than base sins he fought, transformed to godly monuments. I have felt his raw silk handkerchief laid on hot flesh, myself retrieved from the dead. Taliesin witnesses the commission to the table. 12 rose from the table, knelt to receive his blessings, faded into waiting night, leaving him alone to raise white walls, save the city from flowing onslaughts of hate. 12 stole their way to the gray cornerstone, lying dust-shrouded, belying blood-spore toil to roll it from earth's shadows without stains. 12 prayed, departed, questing for their grails. They would win strong workers for the city in distant kingdoms. 12 families lay ill, some dying, all hoping. From the jetty, Arthur stared unblinking eastward. A pall darkened low hills. but he saw only dawn, new sunrise, and 12 table nights return. Taliesin reacts to Arthur's revelation. He has counseled me to wed another art, this king who long consumed my words with eager hunger, nourished his sovereign heart on rhythms intricate as misted breath that permeates thought convolutions of blood, mind, soul. He has counseled me to wed another art, to share my single love with another bride, betray beloved words. How can I not act according to his will? How turn my back on his voiced command? But what he asks is harder than cold stones or bearded ice that cracks on river strands. As easily could I love two women equally as sever song from my soul's song. Arthur's Great Hall. It was to be perfect, a perfect place. Sunstones, starstones, moonstones, spire columns to pinion earth to sky, pull time down, embraced vast space between here and eternity. It was to be a citadel, marbled mountain, cresting his city's future folds. It was to house his chosen knight's table without beginning and without end. It was and was not. Even before walls rose sunset high, before roofs sparkled with dew, before squared columns bore weight of ills, his city lay beleaguered by black wrath. His perfect place lay flayed as evil's home, and he lay silent in his secret tomb. Taliesin and the Lamb. Some whispered him a traitor. Even those whose lives cross-linked with his in blood and flesh. Some spoke out quickly to condemn his rash setting off alone on dark western quests. Others jibed against his courage, called him coward, thief, who stole their faith and hearts, set out without them across wide rivers, pit himself against their greater pain, and won. I crept behind in morning shadows, heard his heart break for Camelot, now doomed. Saw her slash his heart with accusations. Felt him swim against black prophetic gloom, stare at silver flecks in Vatic waters, sigh himself to death, our lamb to slaughter. Taliesin bemoans his loss of words. How can I sing his death, though I was there? Forced, final night shock charged with his sorrow for all that would be lost on the morrow. How could I sing that night, though I was there? How can I sing his death, though I was there? Hushed voices sharing a solemn, subtle hymn, him joining as small hours of blood life dimmed. How could I sing that hymn, though I was there? How can I sing his death, though I was there? Rushed frantic rout of traitors garbed in gray, vile act of darkness eclipsing bright day. How could I sing that darkness, though I was there? How could I sing his death? Last moment's flare, harsh bullets rip his flesh, though I was there. Taliesin at the grave of Arthur. 10,000 mourners flowed beside his bier, sorrow beyond measure, sorrow, let me start over. 10,000 mourners flowed beside his bier, sorrow beyond words, measured in dull, slow, still tread, in unashamed, unnoted tears. And where his body rests, they do not know. At evening, blue stone doors slid closed. Those few blood-linked removed his corpse. In fear of foes, maddened for revenge, they hid him from view. But where his body sleeps, they do not know. At midnight, I guarded his secret grave. Heaven opened. Summer rains overpoured their bounds, buried the black portals of the cave. And where he sleeps, I only know. Taliesin overlooks the ruins of Camelot. And now that he is not dead, no, but past, departed, now that his shadow no longer stripes the streets of his glory, what is left from this height to see, to taste in anger? And now that he is gone, where is the whiteness on the hill? Or sunstones and moons and stars he willed to be? And they were as his breath rising, sacred fires from honest hearths. And now that he is gone, what is the cost of our tears, the savor of our silence? Why prolong the agony of these ghost walls waiting doom and bloody violence? Only this, that partings unsubstantial heighten joy in promised, hoped renewal. Taliesin contemplates the vanity of his works. Arthur bled his Grail Hall. I merely sang a score, two score, and more. Through gyring generations since he slept, I sang curved scaling towers, subtle intricacies of time and stone. I soared spun pinnacles beyond massed clouds, seared images in celestial shadows behind my eyes, wove majesty aloud in each taut line, each breath, each melody. And yet, constrained by weight, my grail songs fade, falter, fall to utter silence and to death of song. Tears well, sounds choke, breath stops, sight, frail with age, begins to fail. One with earth, I commence stern closure of my dreams. Yet Arthur's hall still stands. It is, not seems. Memory. Once I could have named their order, the one, the three, the 12, the seven, threes and fives and sevens in price Uptonian display, named his successors through the wave of shock-white hair presiding over decades. I could have told their names in sequence, order, firm, precise, controlled, sung my Davids, Josephs, mourned the passing of my Rubens, and named with sureness of foresight the coming order as I waited patiently through prophecies of dates and pretenses of symmetry and time. No more. Blurring shifts of time and memory have hollowed me of hope and clarity. I have set my feet upon gray dust-crowned grasses, circling faint trails he only in his visions trod. I have felt warm winds roughen hills across breath-brittle plains and known his people's footstep as they filed past palisaded walls stained brown with sweat and blood, known the heart-flint ache of shallow graves and shattered bones consigned behind. Mute testaments to words haunt echoing thin air as he departed on western winds. And I have felt his soul presence near, stepped in their footprints, drunk their tears. Envoy, Taliesin's Testament. If you have lived these verses well, remember I was Taliesin, once Arthur's bard. In my mouth, earth and air transshifted, fire with water intermixed. In life I heard his voice speak mysteries, visions word-clothed. In his defense I emptied out my hoard of poetry and scattered, nothing loath, all of myself upon four questing winds. In that lay immortality, that both of us extend beyond our time, expand, me through seed word, he through root prophecy, bud green and burgeon in the soils of minds. His voice and mine recall his story's splendor. And you who live these verses well, remember. I thought I was finished with this whole epic business at the end of Taliesin, and then realized I had really arrived at the point at which I had been moving for 30 years. And that is the last sequence of poems that I completed, which I won't read today for several reasons. They're called Elementals. And they are sonnets that attempt to break down the form into its elements, to shatter all conventions, to reduce everything to basic constituents. And because I'm a Renaissance scholar, because I love Milton, because I took chemistry in high school and hated it, and because I still don't understand what the periodic table of elements is, my elements are earth, air, fire, and water, and how they mix together to create all things. And Elementals, which is just published this month, has on one page one of my sonnets that deals with earth, air, fire, or water in one of its manifestations, and on the facing page a quotation from Parley P. Pratt's 1888 fourth edition of Science of Theology, or John A. Widsoe's 1919 edition of Key, a Rational Theology, in which they make a statement about cosmos, and I counter it with a poem. Unfortunately, they are all tongue twisters, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to get through them today, so I didn't even think about reading them. The point of the presentation: poetry is not dead. Poetry does not have to confirm what we know. It can explore things we do not yet know. It does not have to simply say that which we understand. It can take two things that are powerful: the story of Joseph Smith, which is true, the story of Arthur, which is also true, but in a very different way, and can combine them to create a kind of truth that is, I think, larger and somehow more penetrating than either individually. History is history, myth is myth, but poetry is the way by which we speak who and what we are. If I hope anything out of the presentation, it is that you will give poetry a chance. Not necessarily mine, but someone's. Enter it, immerse yourself in it, accept its rules, and emerge from it different. I'm really quite surprised today that I made it through. Last night while I was reading through the Taliesin poems, I found myself crying. And I don't cry easily, and I wrote the silly things. But even so, every now and then there's a phrase that just does it. So, these are my attempts at a Mormon epic. I'm very gratified by responses to them. The Taliesin poems have been on the internet in several locations and are still on the internet. The Nephiad has been read by several BYU faculty who have given me the privilege of being one of four major epic writers in Mormon history, one of only two in this century, and the last of this millennium. You know, if that's, you know, means anything to you, but it means a great deal to me. Any questions or comments, or since I didn't make any claims, there can be no rebuttals, but at least questions and comments. Yes. To Richard Craycroft at BYU, there are two currently writing. His brother Paul, with a long poem called, oh, I just lost the name. I'm sorry. A Certain Testimony and the Nephiad, and that's it. It's not an easy task. In the first place, to say you're a poet requires a kind of arrogance. Most of us talk about our stuff rather than our poetry. And it requires a certain age, and it requires a sensibility, I think, for what poetry can do. For the communal nature of poetry, that is, poetry that is intended to reach out and bring people in rather than to push them further away. I think most of us are intimidated by it when we study it. We are told it must be unintelligible, obscure, and difficult, or it's not any good. If it's easy, clear, and precise, then it's not really poetry. And by its nature, epic poetry claims to be the apex of poetry, the highest form of poetry. I'm really a very shy person. I don't mingle well, I don't talk well, but boy, you put a pen in my hand and I can become one of the most arrogant people you will ever meet. And for that reason, there aren't very many of us who tackle it. No, there aren't. There are the four that have been mentioned. Orson Hyde's from the 19th century, a later one from the 19th century that I have not yet seen called The Exiles, and Paul Craycroft's poem and mine that are complete. Yes. Yes. The Nephiat is written in, not in blank verse. It is not unrhymed iambic pentameter. It is Miltonic decasyllabic verse, which means every line has 10 syllables, except for the ones that have either 9 or 11. If you read Paradise Lost, you will find that the first line refutes iambic meter. And it is not intended to be read ta-tum, 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 ta-tum. It is instead syllables arranged in such a way that you take a deep breath and you move through an entire passage. And I was startled, honestly startled, when I was working on the Nephiat to find that I could write, in one case, by pen on lined paper, 200 lines of decasyllabic verse and not change a syllable of it. In the middle of it was a name that I could not recall having ever heard in my life. You never call anyone by their name in an epic. You call them by the name of their father, their grandfather, or something like that. And so I referred to Amram's son, and it fit the meter, it fit the alliteration of the lines, it fit everything in those lines, and I had no idea who Amram was. It took me 3 days to find him, looking in every dictionary I could locate at the university. And of course, it's Moses' father. Somebody taught me that, I know. But if you had walked up in the halls and said, quick, who is Moses' father? No way in the world I could have pulled it out. But the line, the rhythm, the meter, the poetry required that, and it was there. And there are places in the Nephiat where I look back at it and say, I didn't write this. I don't remember writing this. I don't remember thinking that way. And there are passages in it when I went through to revise that I couldn't touch. There were others that desperately needed touching. But I agree with you. I think to a certain extent, poetry is a mode of inspiration. Milton certainly believed that. And those people who choose poetry as their mode of expression do so because it allows us to say things that really cannot be said any other way. Is that an answer? I, as you can tell, I am not a new poet. I am not a 20th century free versist, although about half my stuff is free verse. I love free verse, but I'm also a formalist. And the more I work with poetry, the more I realize that once you have accepted a form, you have multiplied your options rather than diminished them. For many years, I was afraid that if I made one change in form, the sonnet police would come and take me away. And they never came. It was such a revelation. There are no sonnet police out there. So I can start with a sonnet that has certain fundamental meanings. It's a square block of poetry. It's about this big. It takes 51 seconds to read because it has every one of them have the same number of syllables. I can take that form, go back to 1500 when it first entered English and see how it changed, how it was incorporated, the way the language was molded to fit the form, the way the form was molded to fit the language, bring it up to the present, knowing all of the various rhyme schemes, Petrarchan, Shakespearean, Miltonic, Wordsworthian, and all the rest, set it there and say, now, what do I want to do with this? I would suspect very few of you noticed the rhyme scheme in very many of the Taliesin poems. You're not supposed to. Part of what I wanted to do was write a sonnet that sounded as if it could be spoken by a human voice, which means no eftsoons and twas's and twer's and all of the old-fashioned language that we associate with sonnets. No love sonnets. They're very harsh. The elementals go even further. Could you pull up?
I said I wouldn't, but I can't resist. Well, it's up here.
Sorry. Let me give you an example of where that sonnet form can go. This is a poem called Creek Rock. And it simply attempts to compress all of geologic time into 14 lines. Creek Rock. Creek rock, sleek rock, ticking geologic time, cold moss hung clock, intrusion, fractured, cutting, jutting, rutting, ice, magmatic tears, glacial tears, condensed, coarse crystal hardness, thrusting, bursting, thirsting, melting heat, compression into quartz, feldspar, pink-white plagioclase, sheer orthoclase, grain grating crush, crystal into crystal, into light. Softness melts, hardness endures, inures itself to eons, weight, pressure, heat, heat, pressure, weight, and shatters with unending bite, ice, snow, wind, heat, snow, wind, ice, time, abate, weight, thick sediment, clothing, slides away, creek rock glistens, moistens, enlightens day. Now that's a sonnet. It doesn't sound at all like Shakespeare. I would venture to say if I gave you a test and asked you where the line breaks, where you wouldn't be able to tell me. Every line has 10 syllables. Each set of four lines has a specific rhyme scheme. And there's a structural pattern to sonnets moving from large to small that is compressed, encompassed by that sonnet. And yet it's also at the same time been taken apart, fragmented, no punctuation, still easy enough, I think, to understand what's going on in it. And it says something about the nature of our world. So form becomes part of what you're saying. Subject is part of what you're saying. The Nephiad could not be spoken in any way other than it is. The Taliesin poems would fail miserably if I had tried to do it as a 12-book blank verse style poem. They had to be short snippets, vignettes of time. Other questions or comments?
We've talked about form. I'm kind of poetic illiterate, so I'll go to subject.
Okay.
You alluded to it in the Nephiad, two angels.
Yeah.
A number of years ago at a Sunstone Symposium, someone else made a comment on that scripture in the Book of Mormon. It's better that one man should die than the whole nation dwindle in unbelief. They said that could be used to justify any holy war.
Yes.
It seems like it's a very dangerous thing. I guess the cutting edge of religion, like the cutting edge of anything else, is dangerous.
That's the entire eighth book. It's the dialogue between the dialogue over that line, basically. And I handled it by adding an angel, as I said. I showed this to an institute director when it first was finished, and he said, "You can never publish that." I said, "I know publishers don't take epics. They don't like long poems." He says, "No, you can never publish that. There was no second angel." And anyone reading this might think there was. So in the afterword to the Nephiad, I explained this is a poem. It is a fictive device. And therefore, I can have one angel who looks like righteousness, an angel of light, saying kill. And an angel who looks dark and basically is an image we might associate with the devil saying don't kill. That's the law. And point out, I hope, this precise problem. That commandment, that line, is in fact capable of being distorted and used as justification. In his own way, Card does the same thing in all five volumes of his Homecoming series. They all resonate with concern for that same line of scripture. So my answer is, in this case, Nephi must be shown listening to both sides, understanding the cause, the purpose, and on the basis of his faith and his own experience with visions, deciding to break the law instead of keep it. The bad angels always do. They're much easier to make. Now, I was fortunate because my good angel is saying, break the rule. Kill him. And so I had a good angel who was essentially arguing an evil thing. And my evil angel is saying, wait, no. The Mosaic law says thou shalt not kill. And that helped me, I think, avoid the difficulty of presenting evil. It is, as any good Milton scholar will immediately acknowledge, far more enticing than goodness. And it's much easier to create a fascinating evil character than it is to create a fascinating good character. In Book 8, Nephi is the pivotal character, and he's looking at extremes. And I really don't have to give those speakers personalities or names or backgrounds. They are communicating ideas. They're communicating essences rather than beings. So that was basically it. By dividing them, setting them apart, and having Nephi in the center, listening to the two of them argue morality, each reversing what we would expect them to say. And he must choose the good, which is to kill, in this case. Is that kind of answer? It is fun, though, to write about dark things, especially in the middle of deep depressions. I have a whole book of... Well, my scholarship is basically devoted to Orson Scott Card and Stephen King, which tells you something about my imagination. My poetry partakes of both, as well as a whole slew of other things. Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention. I appreciate your comments. And I hope that you at least weren't bored silly and possibly walk out intending to write some poetry or to read some poetry. Thank you very much.